Leonard is the has been a youth pastor for a long time, was a youth director for Youth for Christ, international speaker, trainer, does it all. Church planter, senior pastor. He founded the 4Gen Network, which is all about discipleship to the fourth generation. And we are so excited to welcome him as well as Patrick, but we'll get to Patrick in a second. So thanks, Leonard, for being here, man. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be with you guys today.
Also with us
Guys
is
in a generic sense.
yes. Also being helping me out doing some of the talking with Leonard is Patrick Lightfoot. He's one of our Nexus coaches, also a church planter and pastor of Traverse Christian Church in Windsor, Colorado. So Patrick, thank you so much for being here, man.
Hey, thanks for having me, Andrew. Appreciate you, bro.
Absolutely. So we have a great conversation lined up of talking about unleashing disciple making DNA. And Patrick has known Leonard for years, and we'll get into some of that relationship and how that started. But Leonard, if you would, could you just give us a little bit more background on what 4Gen Network is, what some of the work that you guys do, and just give us a snapshot of your ministry.
Oh, absolutely. The 4Gen Network is focused completely on equipping and training disciple makers. And so we work with pastors primarily in international circles, and domestically, we work with various groups. And we come in and we do training. We teach people how to lead like Jesus did as a disciple maker. We work with pastors internationally on just how to read and understand their Bibles, how to make disciples, how to communicate to people. So it's a broad range, a lot of leadership things that we deal with as well. And we've served people from about 100 countries. Sometimes they come into us. We've trained about 230,000 pastors face to face in the last 10 years. I've done about 35 of those and 35,000, and then the rest of our teams in other countries have done the rest. And we do a lot of other things as well.
Wow, that's awesome. So Patrick, you've known Leonard for a little while. Why don't you give us a little bit of background on some of that stuff? And you've also done some training with him as well for your church and leadership. So just give us.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, what we have done, how I got to know Leonard, there's my son in the
Hi,
background. So he
Patrick.
said he was not going to come back down during this. Awesome. You forgot one thing. Okay. See, these are why webinars are so much fun when you do them from home. Well, the reason I'm at home today, first of all, is we're having VBS and it's way too loud for me to be at the offices. Yeah, I met Leonard in 2011. I was a student at Hope International from 2011 to 2013, and I didn't have to do any residency. All my coursework was online for my master's program. And every time I signed up, this guy kept signing up in the same class that I was in, and it was the first time I've ever had a stalker. And so Leonard was stalking me. From that, we just formed a friendship, and it was great to get to know him. After that, we continued to just touch base. When I was done with my master's, and then afterwards, he went on to get do some doctoral work, and we just became good friends. And I'm so grateful for our friendship, and that has led to us having him come along and do some training at our church 2 years ago, leading from the middle, and walked us through that process of how did Jesus make disciples, and used his methodology. Not didn't reinvent the wheel, just like, hey, what did Jesus do? How did he do it? And walked us through our teams, our staff through it. And so it was really, really good practical application of what it means to be on mission of being a disciple maker. So that is my connection with Leonard, and we have continued to stay connected. And I just appreciate you, Leonard. You're a dear friend. I love it that you don't take yourself serious, but you take Jesus serious. And those are the kind of people I like hanging around.
Thank you, Patrick. And I am still stalking you, by the way.
Oh, sweet.
Yeah.
So what I heard is that he pursued doctoral studies and you called it quits after your master's. Is that
Absolutely. Yes. I just printed off a doctoral thing offline. And so I have
what's
it.
hanging from your
Yeah.
beard behind you? That's your doctoral thing
That's
behind you.
my doctoral work. Yes. That's my quiet time in the deer stand. That's right.
That's awesome, man. Patrick, I'm just gonna hand over to you, just to give some interview stuff for Leonard. But yeah, I want you to share a little bit more about just what that training looked like at your church, and then we can kind of go from there.
Yeah, so he came on site for about 2 days, two full days with our elders and staff, and he wrote a book called Leading from the Middle. And we just looked at the life of Jesus and his ministry and the way Leonard frames it up, and it's so easy for anyone to remember. If you look at the Gospels and the life of Christ, he led from the front. So he talked to the masses, and, you know, not all of his ministry was speaking, but he also led from the back. If you remember when he went to Peter's mother-in-law's house, and there was just a few people at her home where he healed her. And so just a handful of people. And so he led from the front, he led from the back, and we have snippets of that, but the bulk of his investment into making disciples was right in the middle. And that's where he taught and trained and equipped these 12 guys that took the greatest mission to the ends of the earth. And us three and everyone who's ever heard the name of Christ is because of these 12 men were on mission, which is just amazes me. You know, if we were going to go on the battlefield, I wouldn't want 12 guys. I would want an army of millions, and I'd want every weapon at my disposal. And yet Jesus and his wisdom invested in these 12 men. And what would it look like if we just took these principles that Leonard shared with our teams over that weekend and just started doing those, just in investing in the few right in the middle where we work, where we live and where we play, and pour our lives and hearts and what we know about Jesus into them so they can then go do the same things that we're doing with them. So that was the kind of the overview of what we learned from Leonard. And I'll just share this. This is something for me that was super helpful that I learned from Leonard that I share all the time. Is not to use the word discipleship, but use the word disciple making. Discipleship still has like this internal about my learning, but disciple making, we want to think with the end in mind. And that's what we want to do is we want to equip people so they can be disciple makers, not just grow in their own personal walk with Jesus. Yes, we want them to do that. But the premise, the most important thing that we can do is put people on task to be disciple makers. And so, yeah, it was a great training. Appreciate it. And it's been a blessing to our church and to our teams.
Cool, cool. Anything you want to add to that, Leonard?
I would say that's a pretty good synopsis, and think the visual of your own church. Leading from the front would be all your preaching, everything that goes into a Sunday morning. The average pastor in the U.S. spends about 75% to 80% of his time or her time making that meeting happen. Meetings, conversations, planning, training, whatever those things are. Then the back would be the things that go into connecting the body. It's the prayer, it's the visiting in hospitals, it's the compassion. Most small groups function that way as well. It's those connective pieces that say, hey, we're a community of people and we're doing life together. Jesus did both of those things incredibly well. But the vast majority of the things he did was what we call the middle, which is he trained and equipped disciples who make disciples who make disciples. And that's why we're here today.
All right. Well, hey, we're going to get started. I've got a list of questions that I want to go over with you. If you were with us today live on the webinar, if you have any questions as I'm asking questions of Leonard and it prompts any questions you have, please let us know and drop those in the Q&A in the chat, and we will make sure to get those answered by Leonard as well. So, Leonard, I want to start with this very first question. What is great about the church?
Well, you know, I always want to start in this place because the church takes a beating, you know, from the culture, from people within the church, from, you know, there's very few good surveys about the church. And I just think there's just a lot great about the church. She goes where no one goes, to the ends of the world. She loves who no one loves in ways that have transformative power. She says what no one else says. She has a power to offer transformation, to take people from death to life through the gospel and through the work of Jesus on a cross. She's willing to build bridges to people that no one wants to build bridges to the least of these, to those who are hungry. When I was naked, you clothed me. When I was hungry, you fed me. When I was in prison, you visited me. She has weapons that can't be stopped. You know, Jesus said the gates of hell will not prevail. He said that the that the church is his design. And so it's beautiful because he made it. It's his plan. And I just think that there's a brewing movement in the church today that's fresh around disciple making and reproducing. And when I travel the world, I see that it's kind of like the story of Elijah when he was calling down, he's praying, and he's killed all the prophets and all that. And now he's praying because he wants rain. And he sends his servant away, says, "Do you see any clouds?" "No, not yet." And I just think there's been a host of people praying, "God, do something with the church." And eventually he says, "Do you see anything?" And he says, I see a cloud about the size of a man's fist." And when he said that, Elijah goes, "That's enough. That little cloud is enough." And he took off running. And I think the church is about ready to take off running in some new and fresh ways, because there is a cloud the size of a man's fist. And that cloud is the disciple making movement. And that rain is going to come down. And I'm not R-E-I-G-N. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about just God's going to do something.
Yeah.
When people are willing to step in. And so the church is beautiful. And when she uses her power like Jesus, there's nothing like it. It becomes buoyant, becomes resilient. And so that's what's great about the church.
That's awesome. Hey, I appreciate your willingness to share that about the church, because as a pastor, too often I hear, you know, all the bad things about the church. So do you have some stats on the church that seem to kind of paint this picture that's maybe not always flattering? And so what do you see in your travels, your interactions with other churches, pastors, as you travel domestically, globally, in your work with 4Gen Network?
I think there's a lot of difficulty we got to overcome, and all the stuff I shared about the goodness of the church means that we can overcome. Mm-hmm. And so when I share these things, I'm not trying to paint a picture of depression. I'm painting a picture of opportunity. Mm. That God has something he wants done, and he's created something that will do it and get it done. But right now the church is struggling, and the church is struggling in some key ways. One of the ways it's struggling is the fact that we just don't disciple anybody. And what I mean by that is we do not have a system or mechanism that creates generations of disciples. And so right now, almost 9 out of 10 people who sit in the average, I'm going to just say Christian church, as a general description, have never been discipled in a one-on-one or two-on-one or in a small. And I'm not talking about small group ministry, but in a group of two or three guys or gals, mm-hmm. they've never been discipled. And so you have 90% of your church first generation disciples.
Yeah.
That's a problem, because when the pastor stands up with great preaching and says, "We need to be disciple makers," they default and say, "Well, aren't we already? We go to church. Mm-hmm. We give a percentage of our time. We give a percentage of our dollar. We help the church. We even invite a friend now and then." And so the church is struggling to make disciples of the, if you were to say 90%, so 9 out of 10 of that 10% that's left, mm-hmm. 8 out of those 10 people who are left, if you're working off of 100, were discipled by a ministry outside the church, by the way. Young Life, Navigators, Youth for Christ, Crew, somebody like that. And so the church has effectively discipled about 2% of its people. Right now, depending on who you read, Lifeway, Barna, there's a few others, Pew Forum. The majority of pastors today don't disciple anybody. Mm-hmm. They're in meetings. They're busy. Again, they're leading from the front. They're preparing sermons. And the majority, and I say majority, it's about 78 to 82% don't disciple anybody. And then you start looking, those numbers go higher and higher with all of their staff. And mm-hmm. so the only ministry that that does an effective job, well, effective is the wrong word. The only ministry that has a slight, maybe better, is youth ministry, okay. because by nature it's more relational until you get to a certain size. And then and Celebrate Recovery is probably the best disciple making ministry in the church, because it's built into its DNA that what you get, you give. Mm. Those are just a couple things on the disciple making process. Average church is somewhere between 75 and 85 people. I think that's okay. But here's the thing, is we're measuring ourselves off the churches of 2000. And we're taking our cues from, you know, I wear a size 8 shoe, and it'd be like me saying, boy, I can't wait till I have a size 15 foot so I can wear bigger shoes. Well, that doesn't even fit who I am, you know? Right. And so most pastors don't, and we're taught it's kind of a negative, but most pastors don't even have the gifts and the talents to bring a church to 500, 600, 800, 1,000, 2,000, not because they lack talent, but because they're wired differently. Mm-hmm. And so we sit and we hear people. And so I think one of the difficult numbers in the church is how we react to the size of the church, more than the size of the church. And there's a bottom line. We need giving. We need all those things. I think some of the other struggles in the church is that the average follower of Jesus never shares Christ with anybody. Mm-hmm. Or rarely does. Their version of that is, I invited you to my church for Easter or Christmas. We had a gal come to our church at Christmas and Easter for 2 years straight. She finally met Jesus, and she said, the only time I ever went to church was Christmas and Easter. So I knew he was born, and I knew he rose again. I didn't know anything else about him until I met him, and I was changed. And so the average follower of Jesus doesn't disciple anybody, doesn't know how to do that, he's not equipped to that. I was with a pastor friend of mine. He preached this amazing pre-Easter service about all the things God was going to do. And he's a phenomenal, phenomenal pastor. No criticism to him at all. And because he's a good friend, when he was done, I said, you know, you pointed your people to do something, but you never told them how. You didn't prepare them. And so one of the struggles in the church is that we just don't equip people or train people. I was in 49er territory, San Francisco 49er territory, at a church speaking. And I said, if the 49ers trained for football season like you train for the gospel, what would the 49ers record be? And they all said, they wouldn't win a game.
So they would be like the Las Vegas Raiders then, is what you're saying.
Cheap shot.
So Andrew, if you don't know, and those who are watching with us now, he's a huge Raider fan. So I had to get that in there.
Yes. Me and Jesus are.
He's a Raider fan? Did he speak that verbally to you?
I saw it in a dream one night. Yeah.
That's great. That's one of your many gifts. You can interpret dreams. Hey, in your book, Leading from the Middle, I want to just kind of reaffirm some stats you shared. One of the ones that is interesting and I share in some training that I do is the church is increasingly losing its generations. The boomers, up to 50% we've lost. The Gen X, that is my generation, we've lost up to 85% of the Gen Xers. Millennials, up to 92%. And the Gen Z, we don't have a number yet on that. So with each generation, we're losing traction on that. And so that leads me to my next question for you, Leonard. If these are the facts are true, and we want to be open-minded to these facts and say, okay, we have to embrace the reality of these stats that you've shared and that we're aware of, what is the disciple-making DNA as you see it today? And what do we need to do, or what's some shifts that we need to do to move the needle in this area of disciple-making?
Well, I would say that right now, just to kind of reiterate those numbers, there are four major religions in the world. There's Buddhism, Hinduism, Islam, and Christianity. And all four have the same loss, same attrition. They're all losing generations. And part of it has to do with religions and faiths do not change and adapt to culture. And in the Bible, they did. The Jerusalem church was distinctly Jewish. The Antioch church was distinctly Gentile. Mm-hmm. And so they maximized and they leveraged what was in their culture, didn't compromise their faith, mm-hmm. but we have ancient faiths. Christianity, Islam is the youngest of them, Christianity second. And what we have is we have a failure to adapt to learning styles, to culture, to how people understand the way they learn, And so everybody, and half the world's population is under 40. And so what we're doing is we're actually experiencing, instead of the cost of discipleship, which is a great phrase, thank you, Bonhoeffer, we're actually experiencing the high cost of no discipleship. And that's actually very heavy. That's a very high price to pay, which is losing generations. And it's there's a couple of things that go together. And if I'm not getting to your question, just nudge me along.
Sure.
One of them has to do with the way culture impacts the church.
Okay.
We have experienced in our country riots, fighting. We have vilified the evangelicals. We have, I mean, you can go down a list of things. We've been told, we see the encroaching of secular or world values in terms of sexuality, in terms of finance, in terms of, you can go down a whole long list. Integrity, a pastor friend of mine says, I'm just concerned for the character of the church. We lack character because it's infused and encroached. A part of that is because we don't disciple anybody. When Jesus came and he launched the church, sexuality was a huge issue. Race was a huge issue. Slavery was a huge issue. Poverty was a huge issue. You can go down a long list. In the Roman and Greek culture, perversion of gender, all those things were big issues. The church solved those, or at least addressed those through disciple making, by teaching people the way of Jesus, not by preaching, but by literally just sitting down and teaching. This is what it means to follow Jesus, and here's the transforming. And so one of the things that I think we can do is we have to become better students at the scriptures. The movement of the modern church, and it came out of the 50s with his name escapes me. He did the big theater. He rented a theater, Crystal Cathedral, Robert Schuller.
Yeah, it came
out of there, and it moved. The beauty of that is it gave us permission to think as a church about non-followers of Christ. And so people like Hybels, Warren, Schuller, a lot of those folks, we got permission now to start thinking about people needing Jesus. Prior to that, the church was not thinking about that. They were thinking about put up a sign, now we got a church. The damage of that is we shifted to application over meaning in the way that we teach scripture. And so we have this, we teach with application first rather than meaning first, which means we lose mission. It means that we are working with people to say, I want you to be whole rather than I want you to be his. There's a transformative process. I always ask this question, how come we don't read about Mary Magdalene, the demon-possessed woman, or the other people who are prostitutes or how come they never went to counseling? And I'm not against counseling. I've been, and I know Patrick needs it. So,
yes, he does.
but we don't read about that. What we read about is they were invited into a friendship with God and then joined God in what he was doing. And instead of cleaning them up, he transformed them so that even their brokenness was effective. And so we have to become better students at the scriptures as we teach them in all venues. And if you're thinking right now, but my preaching does do meaning, then you've missed half of the middle, or most of the middle. I'm talking about when you sit down with somebody and you look them in the eye, we have to be able to say, here's meaning. Here's what Jesus meant when he said this. Now, how does that apply? What is the principle that we can use? And so that's just kind of a general nut and bolt thing. I don't know if that helps it clarify a little bit.
No, it does. And so I want to, that leads me to this next question, is one of the things you talked about is leveraging our culture. How do we do that today? You obviously alluded to that in Jesus's time, they addressed these issues of racism and gender and poverty. How do we as the church leverage the challenges that we are up against in those same areas in the culture which we live, particularly in the Western culture? I know you travel globally, and there's different issues in different areas of the world, but can you just kind of speak into the Western culture that we're in today?
Oh, absolutely. I would say, first of all, Jesus didn't spend a lot of time talking about those issues. Mm-hmm. He spent a lot of time equipping people, and maybe in private conversations that weren't recorded, but those issues were already ingrained. The answers and the resolution to those issues were already ingrained in the rabbinic and the Levitical law and their teachings. And so he spent a lot of time teaching them about the kingdom, mm-hmm. and about access. And so I think we leverage through relationship.
Okay.
The conversations where we can sit down and just have an honest conversation. Here's what it means to follow Jesus. When I'm discipling somebody, I'm always asking, is that what a friend of God would do? Mm-hmm. How would a friend of God feel about this very thing that God said? How would they embrace that? And now when they're in conflict with what they want to embrace, because they know somebody, they love somebody who embraces a different lifestyle or value and what Jesus was, that's when I say, now, what would a partner with God? If a friend of God embraces what Jesus says, now, how do you partner with God in communicating that love and truth to that person? Yeah. And so we work through conversations, actually just practical. How would you say this? You know, explain to me why this matters. Help me understand. Why do you think God cares about our sexuality? Why do you think God cares about our ethics? Why do you think God cares about poverty and the poor? Now, how do we join him in what he wants done in that?
Yeah.
So that's part of how we leverage that.
Okay. Yeah. Talk about, there's two words that you use to describe, which I don't hear anyone else using, that we are friends and partners with God. We use a lot of titles for the Lord. You know, he's Lord, he's Savior, he's Messiah, he's King. This last weekend, I spoke in talking about Holy Spirit, that he's our advocate. He's our counselor. He's our guide. All these amazing titles and words for the Trinity. But you constantly talk about this partnership and friendship. And I think that's a lens that we don't look through or even consider or think as the church. And so can you just kind of speak into that for a few minutes? What do you mean by friend and partner with God? And what are some things, how can we leverage those terms, I guess, as church leaders in the churches we serve and the communities we live?
I would say, first of all, that friendship and partnership with God are themes that run from Genesis to Revelation. Okay. The Bible starts with this phrase, "Hello, I'm God, I make things." In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. We can say it by heart. We know it's got a poetic, all this other stuff. But the reality of it is God didn't make anything God needed, but he made everything I needed. What an extreme act of friendship that is to open the door of our world to us, mm-hmm. and say, I've prepared a place that is specific and beautiful for you. By the way, he makes that promise again to his disciples. I've prepared a place for you, or I am preparing one. An extreme act of friendship is that God said, the best I have is my image. I'm going to give it to you. The extreme act of friendship is that God said, I'm going to take now of all the beauty that I made, I'm going to take another place and make it just for you. And we call that the Garden of Eden, which was this amazingly huge landmass that went all the way, most likely from Ethiopia and Western Africa, all the way through the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Had four rivers, the Tigris, the Euphrates. It's this beautiful thing. And then this overwhelming act of friendship, to remind us that we're not him, he said, I'm going to put these two trees in the middle of the garden so that you can say, those are accessible to God, but not me. Because I'm not God, and I can swear to this as a truth. Every time I try to act like God, I fail. And that's where my problems begin. And so God says, I want you to see who I am. And this just this extreme act of friendship. When Adam was alone, there's boy dogs, girl cats, boy pigs, boy people, no girl people. And so God noticed that. And he says, I want to make somebody for him, a suitable partner. And he presented her and he went, wow, this is incredible. And so everything God did in the creation story is this extreme act of friendship. Mm-hmm. Now, take that one step further, partnership. Here's what he said. He said, now I've got stuff I want done in that garden and I want you to do it, which by the way, is also an act of friendship because we were made for purpose, his purpose. And so I have name some animals, be fruitful and multiply, work the garden, and all this is coming out. Those two things are embedded in the creation story as the Bible begins. Now take a look at the Old Testament through the lens of friendship and partnership. When God said, I want to rescue the world from itself, he found a friend named Noah and made him a partner and built a boat. When he wanted to launch the promise that he made in Genesis 3:15 and put it in motion, he found a friend named Abram and made him a partner in the birthing of a nation that would bring us the Messiah. And all of Hebrews 11, the hall of faith, as we call it, some people, they're all about people that God made, that, that were friends of God, that became partners with God in something God wanted done. He gave us the law, and he summarizes the law. Jesus does, Paul does, Peter does, and James does with this: love God, love others. Love God, that's friendship. Love others, that's partnership. The entire way of the law hangs on that premise. Jesus said, abide in me, be my friend, and bear fruit, be my partner. And so it literally runs everywhere in scripture. And so when I say to somebody, let's learn to be friends with God, which is what Jesus said in John 15, I'm going to call you my friends. When people learn to be friends with God, and then they begin to say, well, what does God want done in this world? What's around me? Is there somebody that needs to be loved? Is there something that needs to be given? Is there something that needs to be shared? We truly, the more we live to that, the more of a disciple maker we really are. And so that's kind of how I teach that. Those two invitations from God are from the beginning, and they end in Revelation, where he says, and now the dwelling of God is with men and their friends, and he will be their God. They will be his people. And now there's this eternity where we live in partnership and friendship without interruption. And he paints that picture in Revelation for us. And so that's how I phrase it and understand it. So when I'm discipling somebody, I'm constantly saying, God wants to be your friend, and then he wants you to join him. I hope that helps clarify that.
It does. And I appreciate you sharing it, and, you know, from Genesis to Revelation. That is so powerful. And that's one of the phrases I share often when I talk about my friend Leonard Lee. I was like, man, this guy talks about friendship and partnership. No one else uses those words. And so it's just super powerful. So I appreciate that. One of the phrases you shared, I just jotted it down here. God, he didn't make anything for himself, but he made everything for us. And that's what a friend does. And man, that was in the very beginning. And he keeps asking us to be his friend, but also move into that next step of partnering with him in that. So that leads me to my next question. What would you encourage church planters or existing churches to measure as a regular part of unleashing their disciple-making DNA? Do we start counting friends? Do we start counting partners instead of like baptisms and budgets and all those measurables? That those are good, those are important, but I'm sure you're going to share with us there's other things that need to be measured that are more vital. So what are those, and what are your thoughts on that?
I would say don't stop measuring the people that come to your church, because everybody matters. I would say pay close attention to your budgets, because the church needs an integrity of how they invest their funds. We're stewards. I would say continue to measure the people who are baptized, who are in that act of saying, God, I am putting all of me under this, because this is where you are. This is what you've asked of me. Measure those things. I checked, this is my numbers for my doctoral research. Here's something that churches don't measure: the number of people trained and equipped to make disciples. We just don't have a measurement for that. We have a very popular guy who does all kinds of leadership seminars, and he's got, 47 ways and 22 ways and 9 mistakes you make and so on and so on. And he just came out this week with a list of things that we should measure: people in the seats, retention of newcomers, all these other things. But what he has never mentioned in all of the writings, and I've read so much of his stuff already, he never mentions the number of people equipped and trained for kingdom impact. And yet Jesus, when he was saying his prayer to the Father in John 17, he says, Father, that's what I'm measuring. I got these guys and I did my best and they're game ready. They know exactly what to do. Because they know who you are. And so measuring the number of people trained, equipped, and activated would be something that I would encourage every pastor, but especially church planters, because you have a unique opportunity to set DNA differently and moving forward. And I would say measure the number of people you've trained. Okay, we trained 14 people this month. We trained, 120 people, and people who are trained are more easy to activate towards mission. Yeah. People are easy to activate towards vision, but people who are trained and equipped are more easily to activate towards mission. And so I would say measuring the number of people trained and equipped. The other thing that I would measure is as you're looking at your folks, measuring, and this is a hard thing to measure, measure their stories. What are they telling you about? If they're telling you that God gave me a good parking spot, or my back hurt and it was a heavy burden and God healed it, those are stories that people should tell. But if they're telling you about my friend Mike, who didn't know Jesus and now he does, or I had opportunity to share the love of God, invite somebody to become a friend with God, I am working with somebody who is partnering with God for the very first time. Measure those stories, And so if a pastor said on Sunday, I've heard 15 stories this week of people who shared Christ with somebody else, invited them to be a friend, and who are now meeting with somebody in the journey of disciple making, teaching them to become friends and partners, that would inspire an entire community that's your DNA. Yeah. That's what we're about.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that. One of the phrases you said is that the disciples, they were game ready. Yeah. And so let me say it this way. For us to get, what do we as a church need to do to get more people game ready? Is it through that training and equipping? Because I think we live in this culture where it's like very Greek and learning. There's a person up front. Mm-hmm. They're teaching. They're giving you this information. It goes in our brain and then people do nothing with it. And so we've been doing that for decades. We do it that in our schools. We do this in our churches. We do this in our businesses. And so how do we make that shift from this type of learning where they are game ready, not just absorbing information, but like, okay, I'm on the team. I'm in the game. I want to be a part of this. What are some practical things maybe you can share with us on how can we do that?
I would say that it's going to require us to change our schedules. We're going to have to intentionally step back and say, I'm going to give less time to a meeting, which is Sunday, and more time to the mission of Jesus, which is to make disciples who make disciples. God's intention was not to start a meeting, but to start a movement. And the meeting was a byproduct and a tool. And it also came out of Jewish culture because they had meetings. But the byproduct is that we gather together to build each other up and encourage each other. That's not the mission of the church.
Yeah.
And so I would say stepping back and changing how you set your schedule. When I first pastored a church in 1996, we planted a church in a low-income area. It was violent. It was filled with gangs and everything else. I have no idea why we went there. I'm just a short, fat, white kid from the suburbs. But that's where God told us to go. And we started seeing all these people of different cultures and ethnicities and backgrounds coming in. And I realized that I have these people for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And what is there 168 hours in a week? And I've got them for 166.5 hours that they're not around me, which means that they're around someone else. And so what I did was I changed the way I pastored. I changed my schedule. I found ways to not short circuit my preaching, but to not spend, the 35 or 40 hours I was told to spend in Bible school in preparation. And I did that through creating networks of people that, hey, let's all study this together so that we can benefit from each other and such. And so I changed my schedule and I got to the point where I was committed to give 60% of my time to the people in my church in conversations and in disciple making, rather than give 85% of my time to an hour and a half in which I had them. Cool. It just seemed upside down to me. And so I would say to every pastor right now, take some time and examine your schedule. Look at how you invest your time, meeting after meeting after meeting. Is it what we call it, death by meeting?
Yes.
You know, we've got to have this meeting. We got to solve this problem. We got to solve that problem. Well, the way that I handled those things was I gave power away as much as I could. Mm-hmm. Said, you make the decision and whatever you decide, I'll stand by because I trust you, because I've discipled you, I've trained you. And so did we have some bad decisions made? Yes. Did we have decisions that I had to live with because I gave somebody? Yes, we did. But none of those killed us. What they did was they gave me opportunity to disciple that person even further. Yeah. And so I had to change the way that my schedule worked so that by the time I had made that shift fully, about 60% of my time, I work 50 hours a week. That's what they say. It's probably more, but about 60% of that is devoted completely to disciple making, not to trying to get something done and programs. So that's a shift that I made. I changed my expectations. That's a shift you can make right now.
Speaking of that for a moment, because I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
I made it a requirement of anybody who worked with me, whether they were a teacher, a Sunday school leader, a kids program leader, an elder, a board member, a staff person. I said, you have to begin to disciple somebody. Because if that's the mission of the church, and I function off this, that the singular mission of the church is to make disciples who make disciples. Mm-hmm. And everything else is part of how we get that done. And so I just said, if you're on the board, I don't know the structure that you guys choose. We had elders and then another church, we had board members. I told them, I said, hey, you got to be a disciple maker. I'll teach you how. And if you don't want to do it, then you just don't step into that leadership. Mm-hmm. Because if that's what Jesus wants us to do, then let's do it. When I hired people, I asked, who do you meet with? How do you disciple them? What is your plan? What kind of person are you trying to produce? And so I changed the expectations and I literally just raised the bar. Mm-hmm. What I learned in youth ministry is that the higher the bar you set, actually the more people that want to participate because people want excellence. People want great stuff. And so we changed our expectations. I changed my schedule, changed my expectations. And then I changed the ability to, I changed my goal. I was taught early on that the goal of all good ministry is to bring maturity from we make it the gold standard. We want to present everybody as mature in Christ. And Paul says that.
I would say, Paul says that, but Jesus never uses that word.
He never uses the word maturity.
That's right.
But he talks about fruit all the time. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I did was I changed the goal to bearing fruit, believing that when we learn to bear fruit well, we can't do that apart from abiding in him. And so maturity is a byproduct of that. I just moved to Tennessee and I'm trying to grow a garden in Tennessee. My garden in California, I had these 7 beautiful tomato plants that yielded 4 tomatoes. And I thought, that's a picture of the church. We've got these beautifully mature plants that look amazing, but we're just sitting around going, where's the fruit? Where's the fruit? And so I changed the goal. I was with a group of pastors in Southern California, and we'd spent 2 days trying to figure out what maturity in Christ looked like. What a grand investment of time, right? We spent 2 days. We put the big sticky papers on the wall. We did everything we could, and we could not come up with a single definition we all agreed on. We all came up with good things, biblical things, but we couldn't come up with a definition and said, well, let's try this a different tact. how did you become mature, assuming we're all mature? And so I looked at one person. He says, my grandma, my parents all love Jesus. I grew up in the church and I became mature that way. Great. How did you become mature? My grandma was a drunk. My grandpa was a drunk. My parents were drunks. So-and-so committed suicide. I was in prison. I met Jesus, hit rock bottom, and I became mature that way. And we had 40 different people and 40 different stories. And so we're aiming at maturity, that something we can't define clearly and agree upon. Mm-hmm. And we're aiming at something that the process is different for everyone or for most of us. Rather, the process of fruit is very singular. How do we teach people to go from following to bearing fruit? And that's a single process. That's a step-by-step process. And so I changed my schedule. I changed my expectations and raised the bar. And then I changed what I was pursuing in terms of fruit versus maturity.
That is awesome. A couple more questions. We've got about 15 more minutes here. What is the one single thing that we can do to begin unleashing just a God design, culture making DNA of disciple making in our churches? Since we've had literally 5 or 6 decades of this Greek way of learning, pastor, preacher, CEO, teacher, professor at the front, we take notes, write it down. And then how do we move people to getting them in the game? If you could narrow it down, I know it's a big question with a lot of parts to it, but like, what is the one thing you would encourage church leaders to do with just one step? What's that next one?
Pastor, if I could just say to you, you've got to become the chief disciple maker. Mm. If you don't do it, no one else will do it. And I hear pastors say, well, I'm just not good at that. Then I say, get good at it. Learn. You're smart. You're educated. You understand the scriptures. You understand people. Don't start with, I can't do it. Start with, I need to do it. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things I would say to all pastors, especially lead pastors, don't farm that out to somebody else. I got a buddy who says, I love what you teach. That's why I just hired a discipleship pastor. And I said, what you just did, and he's a dear friend, and we can talk this way. I said, what you just did was you said, I'm the CEO. I manage, mm-hmm. but I don't make disciples, but I'm going to tell you to. Well, tell me one family system that works in. There isn't. You know, do as I say, not as I do. We model that. Mm-hmm. Jesus said, what you see me do, now you go do. Mm-hmm. So I would say pastors just start. When Jesus started the process, he understood it in light of the mission of God, that he was going to bring a movement, not a meeting. Second of all, Jesus understood it in light of this is how you glorify the Father. In John 17, he says, Father, I have glorified the heck out of you. Mm-hmm. And I did it by making disciples and training these guys. So now glorify me by making them successful.
Yeah.
Make another generation. And so I would say, first of all, pastor, you start. If you don't know how, man, let's get trained. Let's learn how. There's some great resources out there. There's some great processes out there. The other thing that I would say too is it starts with prayer. And you know, when we come into this thought process and you're fighting with it, and I know some pastors will, it's like, but I've got so much other things to do. Can I just encourage you that Jesus had more to do than any of us? And this is what he chose to be more effective. And what he did was the night before he chose his disciples, he went away and prayed.
Mm-hmm. Luke
says, I don't know if it's true or not. My imagination says this, that Jesus and the Father had a conversation. He says, Father, who do I choose? And he says, that guy, Peter, and his brother, Andrew, I like them. I'll choose him, Father. Because Jesus in John 17 said, you gave these people to me. Mm-hmm. You picked them for me.
Yeah.
And so when we start with prayer and this learning to do it, we now become stewards of people rather than shepherds of people. Mm-hmm. And I think shepherding is a big part of pastoring, but stewarding the lives and the gifts and the talents and the abilities of other people, that's part of disciple making, you know? And so I would say those things, when Jesus sent his guys out on their last, on their first mission trip, one of the things that, that he said as a parting shot was, whatever you've been given freely, give away freely. So don't complicate it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not about 47 classes on theology, and it's not about church membership. It's not about the next steps and all the great things that we do. It's really about sitting face to face and say, God has told us to be disciple makers, and I want to teach you how. Will you join me? Mm-hmm. I've been praying for you, and you're the name that God's given me. I think sometimes people will say no, but most of the time that's hard to say no to. Sure. Would you like to learn how to do the very thing Jesus instructed us to do? Would you like your life to have a purpose greater than itself? Mm-hmm. And then you praise the heck out of it. So, Pastor, it's just got to, you've got to become the chief disciple maker. And when you do, you do that by inviting other people in, saying, let's go do this together. Mm-hmm. Let's go figure this out. That's why there was a Peter, James, and John. That's why there was a 12. That's why there was a 70. And that's why there was 120. Because he continually invited people in. Let's come in. Let's come in. Do this. Let's do this. Let's do this. He only took three people up to the mountain of mm-hmm. transfiguration. And then he had to tell one of them to shut up.
No. Peter, of course, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that story, you know, in Luke 6, where he goes up and prays all night, comes down, and he chooses his 12. You know, I've done some study on that, and I believe probably between 120 and 200 disciples, and those are the 12 he chose. So I had this thought, how bad were the other ones that he didn't choose? Because I know the 12 he chose were knuckleheads, right? and so that just tells me that God's ways are so much greater and higher. We would have had a job fair for recruiting the best of the disciples that were the most theologically sound and best dressed and all those different things. And yet it was just done through prayer. And so I appreciate that powerful reminder that you've given us. Yeah. I've got one more question, and then I'll have Andrew put a bow on this, wrap this up for us. I just want to pick your brain for just a few moments here as we close, just intentionally developing leaders. I know that's one of the things you're gifted at, that you're spend intentional time doing. What kind of investment does that require to make this happen? You're investing in leaders all over the globe. In the last several months, you've been to Africa. You just got back from India. I know you're getting ready to go to Haiti here. And then prior
Nigeria.
To Nigeria. Yeah, Nigeria. But you're going to Haiti before our gathering in Estes Park, I believe, correct?
I think it's Estes Park and then Cuba.
And then, oh yeah, Cuba. I said Haiti. I'm sorry. Excuse me, Haiti. So you're investing a lot of your lifetime resources, everything you have into this. So just tell us in a few moments, what kind of investment does that make, and what are just some practical things for us to develop leaders just in our own context?
Well, I would say take full advantage of technology. We have people say, oh, I hate Zoom. I hate texting. I hate email. Stop hating. Start embracing and using it, not as a substitute, but as a tool for connection. I would say have a clear, for me, I have a clear picture of what I want to see done. I was with a group of pastors in Brazil, and they said, we've cracked the code to disciple making. I said, that's the best thing I could ever hear. Tell me what it is. And they said, it's face to face, it's up close and personal, and it's skin on skin. And I said, oh, tell me more about that. They explained that it's basically highly relational. I said, that's beautiful. I said, can I ask you a question? I said, when you've spent 3 years, and I only picked 3 years because Jesus took 3 years. Mm-hmm. When you've spent 3 years with your disciples, what do they know? What can they do? And what's their mission? Mm-hmm. And it was like I had scratched a needle across a record or something. They looked at me like, what? I said, if you study John 17, Jesus could tell you the answers to those questions. What do they know? They know the Father. What can they do? They can make disciples. And what's their mission? To build generations. Because it tracks with Jesus's prayers to be disciple makers. They knew how to do it. They knew their mission, and they knew the Father. And so when you are sitting down and investing in a leader, have a clear have a clear answer to what you're trying to build. I want to make sure what they know is what Jesus wants them to know. I want to make sure that what they can do is what Jesus actually asked us to do. And I want to make sure that the mission they have is actually the mission that Jesus gave us. So when I'm investing in leaders, I use technology. I have a clear picture of what I'm trying to do. I think that encouragement and spotting success as well as failure is important. We can spot failure just like that. But I think when Jesus, the 70 came back, or 72, depending on your manuscript, they came back. What did Jesus say? Oh, you guys killed it. I saw Satan fall like a star falls. He affirmed them. He built them up. He says, you guys killed it. And then he drew them even in another step. He says, but the most important thing is your mind. Your name is written in a book. And so that is that whole friendship partnership thing in reverse right there, right? You guys were incredible partners, but you were partners because we're friends. And as he drew them to that, and so I would say, always take your disciple, if you want to be a great leader that way, always draw your disciple back to friendship with God and partnership with God, because that's, if you wanted me to sing a song, you'd need auto-tune. That's how we auto-tune disciples. Bring them back into friendship, love God, and partnership, love others. And we auto-tune them so no matter what your gifts are, if you're musical or not, you can at least carry the tune that God is singing from heaven, my kingdom, up there, down here.
Yeah. So what I just learned is I need to go buy an auto-tuner. Yes.
Become an auto-tuner.
Become an auto-tuner. Okay, that's going to be my new prayer. I'll become an auto-tuner. All right. Well, hey, well, thanks for sharing. Andrew, do you have anything that you'd like to ask or share as we have just a few moments to finish this up?
I probably got another hour's worth of questions or different things that we could talk about. But Leonard, just to, for guys that are interested, just to learn more about you, to be connected with you, or even have you coming in as a trainer, what does some of that stuff look like? What are some resources that you have for our guys?
We do training. We can do broadcast, simulcast. We can do the lead from the middle process. And it's just moving people into the whole idea of that adjustment of schedule and mission. We also do some other training on Too Good to Keep. And it's really just how to practice the nuts and bolts of making a disciple who makes a disciple. You can find me at leonardlee.com or 4-Gen Network. Or 4-gen.net, sorry, 4-gen.net. Or you can call me on my phone, 916-835-6360. Email me, find me somewhere. And we'd be more than happy to encourage you, find ways to support you, find ways to answer questions, and to help you become the tip of the spear in the disciple-making process. That comes with a warning. Being the tip of the spear can be incredibly lonely. It can be very difficult because you're going to say things and see things that you can no longer unsee. I can't go back now and just do a Sunday morning and call that my ministry. I've got to make disciples who make disciples. And so find me in any way. There's contact forms on all our websites, 4-Gen Network, as well as leonardlee.com. They come straight to my email. There's ways to get in touch. So anything like that, we're happy to serve you. We don't come in as the experts. We come in as the servants. We just want to make we want to help lift you up so that your ministry can thrive.
Awesome. Awesome. Patrick mentioned it earlier. Leonard has a book out, Leading from the Middle. Know that he highly recommends that one as well. So guys, thank you so much for your time today. Leonard, Patrick, thank you guys. Appreciate it.
You bet. Absolutely. You can get those
Thanks on our website. Cool. We'll see you guys later. Bye.
Thanks.
All right. Bye.